I really got to get to see the Bear Attire story here because
that's really important. But there were personalities that wanted a special tire. So as we would have to have a mold made, engraved, and as I say, we just take an example. We made the mold for Theda Bear, and as the tire went down the road and happened to hit a little moisture, he would print Theda Bear, Theda Bear, Theda Bear in the road. As I recall it, it was a green tread with a yellow sidewall. We made them for Fairbanks, I remember. There were a number of people, that, particularly the movie picture people, that wanted something very special.
This was, now we're talking about the early 1920s.
Oh, yes, early 1920s.
She was a silent movie star, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, when did you, can you recall about what year the carbon black came in, you started using that?
Oh, must have been very early 20s, 22, somewhere in there.
I heard a tale that Goodyear, I think it was, the story I heard was that he was trying to make a real cheap tire, so he put in some ground shells or some carbon black or something just to reduce the volume of rubber and was.
Well,
I was surprised to discover the reinforcing properties. Is that
a lot of them? There have been some tires made with clay. People have tried to use clay as a reinforcement, but that didn't work out very well. It didn't make it. It was difficult to, if you put enough clay in to get good reinforcement, it's very hard to get it to adhere to the carcass of your tire. Then zinc oxide was adopted, and that worked out very well. And then first the carbon black came out. And as I recall, the first carbon black tread I ever saw was, seems to me, it was made by Republic Tire Company in Pennsylvania, and it was called a Barefoot. B-A-R-E, Barefoot, and because it was quite a soft tread, but it improved the wear, and they began increasing, and of course now they use a great deal more carbon black than even they did when I was there. In fact, I think after I got out of it, the use of it greatly increased. And then synthetic rubber came along, and more and more was used, not to dilute the rubber, but for reinforcing
and
wear.
Definitely a part of the composition. Okay, so then you went from Fisk to DuPont.
You
mentioned to me privately that...
We were...
How that happened.
This anhydroformaldehyde paraterlewidine, that this chap had made that I was telling about that had the alpha and the omega, he thought that was it. Well, anyway, we were buying that from Atlantic Dye Stuffs in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and DuPont was coming, getting into the organic chemical trade, and one of their salesmen, who was Warren Kinsman, came up and talked to our purchasing agent. They liked some of the business. And so we agreed to, I guess, split the business and take some from DuPont. And one of the early shipments came in there. I guess I told you this, but it came in drums and nothing but press cake. You know, open the drum and tip it over and the water would run out. That spoiled the Christmas for us three chaps. We stayed there and tried to wangle through and get that in shape so we could use enough of it to get us by until it was replaced. Of course, that was very embarrassing to DuPont. But then, several years later, when we were still doing it, we, of course, began to buy more and more of DuPont products. But now, one day, Ernest Bridgewater, who was then representing DuPont, told one of the fellow named Anderson, Cliff Sanderson, that they were looking for somebody with experience in tires, General Rubber Compound, that they'd like to have to come to Wilmington to see if there were any of the products they had in Dye Works, which it was then called, could be used in the rubber business, and who would be able to service chemicals if they had them. And one of the other chaps, he said he didn't want to come down because he wanted to stay with Fisk. So that left me, and so they asked me if I'd come down. I didn't know much about DuPont. I remember going home and asking my wife if she'd like to go down to DuPont's, and she said, "Who's DuPont?" Which was the general attitude around New England. Nobody had heard of DuPont. Well, so I came down here and went to the rubber laboratory, which consisted of just, there was one other fellow there that he'd had some experience in rubber, but they wanted him to go out to Chicago in sales. So he went out there, and he was from Lee Rubber Company, and he went out there, and I sort of took over, and that was in 1926. Well, I hadn't been there too long when...
I had a question about the rubber lab, but at one point I saw that it was listed as having been started in 1922.
Yes, it was started in
1926?
I went there in 1926. No, Rubber Lab was operating. There again, my memory just fades to a chap who... I wish I could think of his name. But anyway, he was later hired by... a group from, I think it was from Goodyear. My memory is really, since I had this stroke, I can't follow the memory.
Let me go back.
But anyway, it embarrasses me terribly that I can't remember the names or anything.
We can always dig it out if we want while we're editing.
Well, anyway, this chap went into a rubber service laboratories in Akron, Ohio. And he went out and worked with them, and it was a rubber service laboratory. I guess they sold recipes, they sold processes and whatnot. And he was the first one. And then the laboratory was the same one to the... it was a chap... Well, I just can't remember the name, because the first one after this fellow that went to Rubber Service Laboratory went to New York City as a salesman, and he was followed by this chap, Weller, who came from Lee Rubber, and when he went to Chicago, and I came in, and I took over, and then not long after I was there, we began to find chemicals that could be used, and colors and all that, different things, and we began to expand, and we hired more and more people.
When you came to the rubber lab, what kind of... Hello. When you came to rubber lab, how many people did you have working with you?
Of course, I was alone as a compounder for a short time. And followed Paul Sullivan, I think there were three or four in the laboratory during testing work.
You mentioned something a little while ago that gave me a thought or a question that's been in my mind. Were the compounding recipes proprietary? Each company had its own?
I'd say a typical recipe for an automobile tire would be based on 100 parts of rubber, 5 parts of zinc oxide, 3 to 5 parts of stearic acid, And then we put in maybe 40 or 50 parts of carbon black and same amount of zinc oxide, and that was about it. In the early days, our inner tube was made of 100 parts of rubber, 10 parts of sulfur, period. Then later on, they began to put some organic accelerators in and speed up the vulcanization. And, of course, those are the days when the inner tube was made on a circular mandrel and stripped off and then buffed, the ends were buffed, and painted on the rubber cement and painted with a little sulfur chloride and stuck together. And you just hoped to God the thing would last as long as they could put into a tire.
You said you found some organic chemicals from the dye works that were...
Of course, they had this anhydro from Paris, Louis, and then we found that through Ressler and Heslacher, we knew that, which was available to us, hexamethylene, tetramine, and then we knew... We got in and found the diphenylguanidine at the same time Dow was getting into it. It became highly competitive that way. And I think the real find we had was phenylalphanephthylamine, which is an antioxidant. And that was a big part. And then we found that you could buck that up by adding some other materials to it.
Did you get patents out of this work, or was this all...
Patents were taken on secondary means, like diphenylamine. Goodrich also came out with phenylbetanaphthylamine. We had phenylalphanaphthylamine, and we had some adjustment being made on that. But they were mostly commonplace organic accelerators, because aniline, everybody knew that, aniline and mixed with amines, which aniline is amine, but with an aldehyde, you got there was a whole series, a long series of accelerators made, amine and aldehyde combinations.
Did you get into peptizing agents?
Oh, yes.
Rubber and so on?
Yeah, that later? Came along, peptizing agents. That was the work of Ira Williams.
Oh.
And he was the fellow that really got into the peptizing. And he was a pioneer in that.
What was the Chambers Works like in those days when you first came?
Well, it was a hodgepodge, I'll tell you, if there ever was a hodgepodge of pipes and smells and...
I know at that time, was it the largest organic chemicals plant in the United States at that time?
Yeah, yes it was. It was. And some of the memories of that, we used to go over on the old days, over on the ferry, back and forth, and then we had to get off the ferry up there and walk pretty nearly half a mile down the seawall, and it was pretty tough going there on a cold day with the wind blowing off that river.
I remember tales of that. The bridge was built just before I got here.
Yeah.
You couldn't persuade Dorothy to live in Pensgrove?
No. She was glad to live over here.
Well,
he had advice from somebody. That would do better.
Mm-hmm.
We had advice from some friend that you would do better if you stayed in Wilmington.
Yes, I was going to...
Well, I guess... most of the technical people, at least, seem to have lived in Wilmington and taken the ferry over, is that
yeah.
right?
Yes, they did. Yes, there was.
In the morning getting up.
Say, when was the college that Sally went to? What was the college that Sally attended?
Beloit.
Oh, Beloit,
yeah.
Wisconsin, yeah.
Okay.
I know that.
Yeah.
Would you like to have a tea, or am I getting in there?
Tea is fine, thank you. Well, I see you had the dye works, Tetraethyl lead was...
Yeah. You see, when I first came to the Dyworks on this job, the rubber lab was not known, it was not a separate entity. We were a part of technical laboratory, yes. And my boss was Dr. Rose. And I worked with him, and when I went in there to report to him, he said, Hayden, I don't know the first thing about rubber. You don't know the first thing about dyes. Let's call it quits. You tend to your end, and I'll tend to my end. If you get in trouble, let me know. I'll try to haul you out. that was my introduction. Do you ever know him? Because he was a very fine man.
I recognize the name, but yeah. I think he must have he was gone on to better things by the time I got there. You were part of technical laboratory.
Yeah. I was part of tech lab.
Okay, then let's see. DuPont must have gotten into the tetraethyl lead.
They were in it when I came.
Yeah.
But in a small way, and one or two of the rubber chemists over and the people in rubber chemicals at Jackson Laboratory had been in the tetraethyl. And had been transferred over there to get out of it because some of them had been had a little touch of lead poisoning, I guess.
I think Fritz Downing had been gotten his lifetime exposure to lead or something like that.
Fritz was one, and that was names just escaped me. I see them in my mind.
They do too. In fact, I was going to bring over a picture technical staff at Jackson Laboratory taken in 1951 to see how many of the people in there you recognize,
yeah.
Because I knew most of these people, but I couldn't recognize, or I can't call
well,
them names.
You know, I suppose Fritz, there's a whole lot of those fellows
came
over.
Well, I was going to come back. In fact, some of these names I'll be bringing up later, perhaps. What did you have close interaction between Jackson Lab and the technical laboratory?
I was much closer to Jackson Lab than I was with the tech lab because they were doing a lot of work over there in rubber chemicals, and I was working with those people over there, Bill Calcutt and Don Powers and the chaps sitting working on rubber chemicals. And so I spent much more time with
had
them.
Had the Newport Chemical Company been acquired then?
No, that was considerably much later.
Okay, well, now, without skipping over the neoprene story entirely, I think you've written about this, and I have... I think we have a pretty good understanding of how you got involved first with neoprene. Let me ask, you were really the person, principally though, who learned how to mill it and compound it and make it and come up with recipes that...
Yeah, surely. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. In other words, I found out from the very first piece that we ever had that I had used... rosin, and then used magnesia, and I found that those were quite essential. Now you could use zinc oxide in place of magnesia, but you got in trouble because it was vulcanized so fast.
Oh, really?
It's much more active. And
chemically, what did the oxides do? Did they react with the chlorine, or did
I suppose? I always suppose that's what happened. But and of course, carbon black was essential because it that to control it.
Let me ask a broad question that might lead us in the other direction. What, quite aside from, including but not necessarily restricted to things in science. What do you think your major contributions were?
I don't know. Well, of course, I think the first thing was finding out what the essential things you had, what the things you needed for processing and vulcanization, which is, as I say, is rosin and magnesia. But after that, of course, in the compounding and leading a group of men to compound for specific purposes. For example, compounding for covering of secondary distribution electrical power line. You'd go down in those early days, you'd go down the road here where they were distributing power, and you'd see the rubber insulation streaked off, hanging, being flopping in the wind. And that was one of the first things, because we found that neoprene was very resistant to sunlight if it was compounded with carbon black. And that's, I think, one of the very first experiments we ever made was at Roebling, was to cover a wire with a neoprene composition. But then you were compounding for that particular job. Of course, you had to add softeners for extrusion purposes and various compounding ingredients to give some special use. But and you had compounding for sidewalls of tires, which is also has always been a good use. And then you have the compounding for automotive parts and the rubber parts that go around an automobile, hose to carry solvents, hundreds of different products. We had to think about what to use and try to compound something that could be used.
At the same time, of course, it was the research and development on the manufacture, the polymerization of chloroprene. Were you involved in that directly? Or
only the evaluation of the products that they brought out. Mm-hmm. For example, as you know, the first neoprene was made in 5-gallon bottles, chloroprene put in 5-gallon bottles, subjected to Cooper Hewitt lights.
Yes.
And you'd run it until you got a syrup, then you'd drown it with alcohol, pull out the polymerized product that was still kind of elastic, and clean that up, and then...
Did the people who were doing the work on polymerization understand what they were doing in terms of did they have any concept that this was a free radical?
Well, I think Ira Williams did.
Ira Williams?
Yes.
You know, that's interesting, because that was a name I saw it in the literature, but I didn't really know who he was.
Ira Williams came to us.
He was an organic chemist, was he?
He came to us from Grisselli. Mm-hmm. And he had put together an accelerator, 808 and 833, were two accelerators that he had produced. They were aldehyde amine products. But when he got there and he got a hold of some neoprene, got to working with that, he really got into that. He loved it and worked at it. I think he knew what he was doing.
And then he got back into the polymerization.
Yeah.
But he came to you first to do curing, or?
He was assigned to us for rubber because he had been working on rubber chemicals for Grisselli in Cleveland.
Yeah.
So it was just a natural, he came and worked into rubber at Jackson Laboratory, and we worked very close with him.
Okay, let's see. I think it was, if I recall correctly, it was Howard Starkweather who did the first emulsion, the first successful emulsion polymerization.
Well, Howard, yes. Howard Starkweather worked with Carruthers for a while. And, Howard contributed a great deal.
You probably didn't talk in those days about free radical polymerization,
chain transfer agents,
molecular weights.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I said that Howard Stock, where they contributed a great deal to the study of polymerization. I think he knew what he was doing. He and Ira Williams put those two fellows in it. And of course, there was another chap there, Jackson Lab, that was pretty much into it too.
I'll, have a list of those names that we might come back to later. I'll be asking you about some of them. Okay, let's see, you were involved, I guess, pretty heavily with neoprene then, from the rubber lab point of view anyway, for several years?
Yes, until 41.
Until 41, right.
When they built the plant in Louisville.
Yes.
And I came over to Wilmington.
Were there other things going on at that time that were important in your mind?
Well, of course, there were these other polymers that are coming along. Vitone and... one of the most interesting pieces of rubber... they got one around here, but it's called adiprene.
Right. In fact, I have a list.
I don't know.
I have a list of the other.
Remember those? I've got a piece of that adiprene around here somewhere.
Okay. Let's take your mic off.
Oh.
So you don't get tangled up there. No. All right. Bill, let me switch to have a brief history of your career at DuPont, and then we'll come back to some of the details. According to my records, you were headed rubber lab at the Chambers Works
from 26 to 41.
26 to 41.
Yeah.
And then you went to Wilmington as assistant manager of rubber chemicals.
Yeah, division of Orchem.
Okay, we're back on the air now.
All right.
Then, about 1954, you were assistant director of sales.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1956, special assistant to sales for Elastomer Chemicals.
Yeah.
Department, right?
I always felt that I was really mostly more like a technical sales manager than anything else, the kind of work that I was doing at that time.
Okay, let's see, after you...
I had some concern, this needn't be in this here at all, but I had some concern actually about that time. You see, I was working with Ernest Bridgewater, and he was two or three years younger than I, and I was his assistant. And Jack Daly was general manager. And I went to Jack, and I said, listen, you got to do something about this organization, because here I am as Ernest's assistant, would be the man you might logically want to push along if you ever moved Ernest up. And so you got to find somebody that ought to be his assistant that could move on up, because I'm older than he is. I'll be going out of here before he is. Therefore, I think you ought to do something about it. Well, that's what started all that thing, and then I became an assistant. That's what happened.
Well, and that's all pertinent information.
I felt very strongly about that. I shouldn't keep that spot, because... if something happened to him, I was too old.
I'm going to stop at this point because we're near the end of the tape, and it'll be easiest just to change it now.